Tonight is a very auspicious night for the Buddhist Society and Western Australia in general, and all of Australia really, because last night in a cloistered ceremony at Bodhinyana Monastery, our four nuns were fully ordained into the Theravadan Buddhist tradition. Firstly, Ajahn, Sister Vayama, Sister Naroda sitting next to her, Sister Seri sitting next to Sister Naroda, and Sister Hasapana at the end. It was a very moving ceremony last night, and it was held in a fairly quiet way. And that's why tonight we wanted to really make this a great celebration for the nuns. So what I'm thinking of, first of all, I would just like to formally present our fully ordained nuns to you all, and perhaps even just fill the hall, I think, with a cheer. Perhaps three cheers. Say, hip hip. Hip hip. Hip hip. Hip It's not that often that our hall gets filled with rapturous applause like that, but this is certainly an occasion where it's well worthwhile. As you probably know, the fully ordained, certainly in the Thai tradition of the bhikkhuni hood, has died out many, many hundreds of years ago, and really last night was an attempt to perhaps start that tradition again. So it's a very, very auspicious occasion. It's pretty hard to even imagine. I have a hard time just even thinking about the enormity of what we've done there, just in reintroducing the nuns back into this stream of Theravadan Buddhism. So it's a terrific occasion, but I might say not necessarily without its controversy. But I'd like to stay first of all just with the celebration side of tonight. And just to let you know that this occasion has been watched by many, many people right over the world. We've had faxes and emails from many, many countries. And I just wanted to just share with you one that I know Ajahn Brahm probably hasn't seen yet, but from Angie Monksfield in Singapore. Ajahn was there on, I think, Wednesday night?
Yeah, on... what day is it today? Friday, that's right. Wednesday night, yes, Wednesday night.
Anyway, she says, thank you for taking the step to ordain women to become full bhikkhunis in the Theravadan tradition. Whilst many have just accepted the tradition and not wanting to rock the boat, we are grateful that you are doing what is right. After all, this will bring great benefits to humanity and to restore Theravadan tradition back to the glorious position, to its glory position, and no longer inferior to the Mahayanan tradition that is enriched by the presence of many well-practicing and hard-working nuns. Just for Ajahn's benefit again here, just to show some of the rock star status he attracts when he's travelling overseas. The 3,000 Buddhist Fellowship members are in full support of the ordination and congratulate you for the historical turning point. The 2,000 people crowd at your public talk last night has given you a thunderous applause in support of it as well. Not a single person raised a hand to object when asked to voice their concerns, if they had any. Now, the reason why I'm just speaking as President of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia here tonight is just really to address, well, to look at the two sides of what's actually happened over the last few days, and that's certainly for us all to celebrate what has happened and never really to lose sight of that. But the fact is that not everybody's been happy about this event. And some countries, indeed, where nuns operate, are probably still coming to terms with what in Australia now we take for granted in equal opportunity laws and freedom from discrimination, those kinds of things that we more or less just take for granted here. But and I know other countries will come to terms with those problems that they have in time. But at any rate, we did realise when we started planning for this that there was going to be probably some controversy and some trouble maybe caused, and the committee, along with the monastic orders, whether we were right or wrong about this, I really still don't know the answer to that, but we did decide that we needed some confidentiality around the planning of the event that happened last night, mainly just so that we could plan for the whole thing in clean air, because there was many things to consider. There was, just the aspect of making sure that the law of the vineyard was satisfied, and that we weren't going to be assailed on that front. And I think that Ajahn Brahm has done a lot of work over the last year in sort of consulting with many people over the world. Not all people agree with him, I might say, and that's another reason for what I just wanted, the remarks that I want to make tonight. But we've tried very hard to tick all the boxes in that regard, and to try and make sure that that we didn't get too much controversy around the whole thing that would just pull it down and you know end up not making it the event that we really all here in West Australia needed it to be. So we always knew, in you know, with our own kind of moral antenna up, that we were doing what was morally right. But nonetheless, we did sort of opt for that secrecy, or if you'd call it that, kept it under wraps anyway. I don't know that we necessarily would say it was secrecy. And for that, I know that a lot of our members, too, were quite unhappy about that. And I would like to apologise to all those members who do feel that they were shortchanged or somehow not given the full recognition of this event. As I say, I still don't really know the way that we went about it, whether it was right or wrong, but we just sort of did what we thought was right. So I would like to apologise if you do feel offended to the members, and I would also like to extend that to our international brothers and sisters, looking directly at the camera and speaking to you. We really do want to be friends with everybody. We certainly don't want trouble to follow this for too long. We realise that it was a very controversial thing that we've done here. I just like to say, personally myself, I mean, I just don't like secrets at all anyway. I think secrets are a terrible thing to keep. And it wasn't really so much like having a secret, but anyway, I would like to ask for your forgiveness if we have offended you. And we do hope that you come and visit us here in Western Australia very, very soon. I would now like to address Ajahn Brahm's involvement in this event. Because it's true to say, without Ajahn Brahm, this event would not have happened. Now, I know that I speak on behalf of all the membership here, and I certainly speak for all the nuns here when I say how deeply grateful we are, Ajahn, for your support.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But let me say this quite categorically. He did not drive this event. Ajahn Brahm did not drive this event. The full ordination of our nuns has been a dream of this Buddhist society, well, for as long as I can remember that we thought that we might have had nuns here. The monastery at Dharmasara started in 1998, and it started, as I think we explained a couple of weeks ago, with just overwhelming energy. The energy to have nuns operating here in Western Australia was just palpable. Just with the way that the money came in, the way that the monastery has started. And Ajahn Varma as the abbot of that monastery, has worked from the beginning to make Dharmasara an impeccable monastery. And it is an impeccable monastery. And we all knew that that really had to be the case, because if nuns are going to re-establish themselves properly in this this tradition, really their behaviour and their practice needs to be of an impeccable nature. And Ajahn Varma and the nuns at the monastery have certainly started off this tradition well over the time since 1998 when the monastery started. Now, as far as Ajahn Brahm goes in this event, you know, I just see Ajahn Brahm as a yes man. I've known him since he arrived in Perth. In fact, I was just telling Bianca when we were driving down to the monastery last night, just before Ajahn Brahm even came here, Ajahn Jagaro said to me, Ajahn, he said...
You never told me this before.
he said you're really going to like Ajahn Brahm. You wait till he comes, you'll see. He's a monk's monk. That's what he said, and so he is too. Ajahn Brahm has developed with this society. I mean, those of us sort of that can remember back to those times, you know, he hasn't always been as vibrant and as you might say, charismatic as what he is these days. In the early days, I mean, I could probably tell you some terrific stories about some of his early talks and so on, as he was when he was practicing and learning to do what he does. But he's not any of that now. Ajahn Brahm is a confident, disciplined, well practiced, and a highly congruent monk. He's not high-handed, as some might want to portray him through this event. His congruency at times, I might say, from my point of view, his congruency is such that it's searing, really. You know, such as the insight that he sees into some things. Sometimes you think, heavens above, Ajahn, how can you even say that? Just what are you saying? You know, but when you contemplate what he does say, you can start to understand just the depth of his own practice and the insight that he's got to in his own practice. Ajahn Brahm never, ever denies a heartfelt plea for some request. His default position is yes. And that's, you know, before a no can even arise in his mind. So, having said those few words, I really do just want to demonstrate to mainly the international community and those that are somewhat unhappy with what's happened, that this event has really had nothing to do with Ajahn Brahm driving it at all. The event is totally organic. It's a situation that's grown from the circumstances that have happened here, particularly in Western Australia. And that's all I'd like to say, just except that I want to congratulate all of the nuns and also the Buddhist Society, all you members here yourselves, the committees over the years, the past presidents. I know there's presidents here tonight, past presidents. I mean, this organisation is a truly splendid example of a fine religious tradition. We've got terrific people working in the organisation. We've got a terrific Sangha. And it brings us much good karma. The event that happened last night brings us much good karma. And may the goodness that comes from this landmark event, may it benefit us and also benefit the world. Thank you.
Thank you, Dennis. And after the talk is completed, you'll have the opportunity to express your congratulations personally to our four new bhikkhunis. And excellent. So I'm just going to be carrying on, but not just being formal, just what this actually means in our own life as human beings. And obviously that one of the things I like to talk about, which many of you ask me, is about decision making. Because whenever you make a decision in life, there is no such thing as a right decision or a wrong decision. As Dennis was pointing out there, did we do the right thing, did we not do the right thing? But in life we should always make our decisions with courage. And by saying with courage, I often point out to people a Buddha's advice. I always go back to the Buddha because the longer I've been a monk, I'm a Buddhist monk obviously, the more I really get inspired by the Buddha's wisdom, the way he set up this system and the advice which he gave 26 centuries ago is still just so powerful in today's world. He talked about when you make decisions like this, it's a controversial decision in the Buddhist world. Many of you who are not in my position don't know how hot it actually is. So it is a very hot issue, but when you're making decisions like this, you know you're going to hurt people and you don't want to hurt people, but decisions are like that. But the Buddha asks you to think of four things before you make any decision. And it's called in Buddhism the four agati. You make sure, you contemplate, am I acting with selfish desire? Is there anything in this for me, basically? And of course, there's nothing in it for me except more problems. Now, are you acting out of ill will because you want to get your own back on somebody else? And there's no ill will involved in decision making. And second most important decision, are you acting with stupidity? Under delusion. And that's the one where this decision to ordain bhikkhunis, this has been being discussed for the last 9 years at least. And one of the first conferences which I went to, we sort of discussed this. We discussed this, we researched this, we've consulted, we've looked at the books, we've looked at other people, we've argued, discussed, trying to find out what's going on. So this is actually the result of, for me personally, about 9 years of hard work getting to this particular point. So you make sure that, as Dennis said, all your boxes are ticked, you're not acting out of delusion, and in particular, it can be done. So there's no problem at all. No one at all in the whole world argues about the legal validity of this ordination. It's only should it be done, not can it be done. So we've ticked that box. And the last thing, which is always says the most important part, whenever you make any decision in life, especially a controversial decision, never act out of fear. Because too often in life, we think we want to make a decision and we're afraid to go that last part forward. And that last part forward, as a monk, and as my Sangha, as the nuns here, as our Buddhist society, I'm very proud of you. You don't act out of fear. Because in fear there's timidity, in timidity there's no possibility of change in our world. And we do have to change. When we see something which is, morally wrong, we're very uncomfortable with it. We know there's something not right here. And sometimes too many people lack that courage. And they do fall back in timidity. And on the aircraft coming back from London to perform this ceremony, I really contemplated, if I didn't go ahead with this ordination, if the other monks didn't go ahead, I would never be able to live with myself. If you act out of fear, you regret it for the rest of your life. So when you're making decisions, always remember those four things. Remember the first thing? People like to have lists of things. First thing, not out of selfish desire, not out of ill will, number two. Not out of delusion. So you do your research, find out as much as you possibly can. And lastly, act with courage in this world. And then you know it is not a wrong decision. It's not a wrong decision because your process of making it was beautiful. But when you make those decisions, there's always going to be some people agree, some people don't agree. So having made a decision, now, it's not the end of the journey yet. Now you have to see what you're going to do next. And how you can make that decision work in life. And this is the reason why I say there's no such thing as a right decision, no such thing as a wrong decision. They're just different decisions and you make them work. So in our life, you may have decisions to make in life. When you're very young, should I marry this boy? Should I marry that girl? Should I change my job? Should I do this particular course at university? Or should I buy this car or that car? Should I leave the world and ordain? Or what should I do? Should I go through this therapy when you got cancer? Or just not have any therapy at all? All these choices which we are made in life, which we have to make in life. Sometimes they're very, very difficult to make. So please remember those things which you should always bear in mind. Selfish desire, ill will, delusion or fear. If you can tick any of those boxes, stop, don't make the decision. And make you check what you're really doing, first of all. And that's how the Buddha taught, and that's how I remember we should make decisions in life. And once the decision is made, just out of compassion and care, let's move this forward. Now the decision making in Buddhism, which many of you may not be aware of, is that Buddhism grew in a democratic system. Recently, when I was giving a talk at UWA on Buddhism and law, I made a very, very strong point that it is cultural arrogance of the West to think, to assume that democracy began in Greece. 100 years before Socrates, when the Buddha was alive, there was long-standing democratic systems in India. India was partitioned into many states. Two of those states, probably the one you may know, is the Sakyan Republic. The Buddha was son of the Sakyans. That was a republic. It did not have a king. It had a group of, you might call aristocrats, landholders, who would meet together in a hall which they called the Sabha. And if there's anyone from India here today, you know that the parliament in India is called Sabha. They meet together in that Sabha to discuss what's going to be decided upon. And everybody had to attend. There's one of the stories there when one monk was oppressing a man who had to go to the meeting, and he said, "I need a robe, you get it now." And because of that, the man was late for the meeting and got fined. And the Buddha said to the monks, "Monks, don't just oppress lay people by saying you want it now. Be patient, you're a monk for goodness sake." But it gave us an insight into how things worked in that time. And the biggest republic was just north of Patna, modern-day Patna, the Wajin Republic around Visakhapatnam. If you ever go on pilgrimage to India, you go to those places. And that was a republic. And the interesting thing is, the Buddha, when he was establishing his system of government for his groups of monks and nuns, that was the system he chose. So we do actually follow a democratic system in our communities. So even though I'm the abbot, I'm very different than the abbot of the monastery up at New Norcia, because in New Norcia you've got a vow of obedience. In our monastery at Bodhinyana we've got a vow of disobedience. No, they're very, very good. But we have a vow, say that every monk is equal. So when we have a meeting, we have one vote, one monk. And sometimes, I've been a monk over 35 years now. And how long have you been a monk now, Vimchanarata?
4 months.
4 months. So we get an equal vote. I think that's really unfair. You should get a vote for the number of years. I should get 35 votes, and you should get, no, a third of a vote. But that's not the way it works. Everyone's vote is equal. Because we're a community. And he can, even though only a monk 4 months, he can put his hand up and stop anything. We can't proceed unless we have unanimity. But that unanimity, the Buddha actually, the way he put it in our legal system, the limit of authority is your local monastery. So every monastery is totally independent of every other monastery. We have friends, we have contacts, we visit each other, we talk to each other. But the legality, the decisions which you make in your monastery can't be influenced by monasteries overseas, or even by monasteries, you know, on the other side of Australia. We have a sense of autonomy there. Now that's very important, just by even the way that Buddhism expressed itself in its teachings later on. We don't have this monarchy, dictatorship, you know, head honcho monk. We don't have a pope. We don't have an ayatollah. No, we don't have no archbishops. Because the Buddha said just before he passed away, and it was just one of those little one-sentence sayings which affected Buddhism for the last 26 centuries. He said before he passed away, someone asked him, "Once you're gone, who will lead Buddhism? Who will be your successor?" And just, you know, the successor in the Christian church, from Jesus to St. Peter to the popes, I think in the some forms of Islam, you know, from Muhammad to his sons. But in Buddhism, the Buddha said, after I pass away, there will be no successor. Let the teachings and these rules, which we call the Vinaya, let the rules and the teachings be your teacher from now on. And that was a powerful statement, because at one stroke, in one sentence, he took away all the dangers of a huge hierarchy. Like a pope who lives a long way away, who tells people what to do on the other side of the world, without any understanding or feeling of the local situation. So it gave us autonomy. And because you have autonomy, it means every monastery, every community, it grows and develops according to its local environment. If it does the right thing, if it's giving the right inspiration and talks to its community, it will grow. If it doesn't, it will fade away. Just like the natural process of a tree growing in a forest. If it's a good seed in the right place, gets enough water and nutrient, it becomes this beautiful big tree. If it doesn't get in the right place, it just withers and dies. So it understands the natural evolutionary process of life without having people control you from over the top. And that's exactly the same way, you know, you've heard the teachings over the while. Every time somebody comes and asks me, Ajahn Brahm, should I have an abortion? Ajahn Brahm, should I get divorced? Ajahn Brahm, should I change my job? Ajahn Brahm, you know, should I marry that girl or whatever, I don't know. And I will always tell you, it's not my place to tell you. I am not just, you know, the Pope of Nolamara. Because that's not the Buddhist way to tell people. Neither it is for groups of monasteries elsewhere to tell anybody. Your job as a monk, as a nun, is not to tell people. As a Buddhist, the only thing you can do is to give advice on how you can make your decision. To try and help you make a wise decision, a compassionate decision. But we will never tell you what to do. And a few people have come up to ask me that, you know, about, you know, does Buddhism believe in abortion or not? Great question. And they say, that question is wrong. Does Buddhism believe in abortion or not? You say, what happens is, this person comes up, they tell you their situation. This is the mess they've got themselves into. As a monk, you would never tell them, do this or do that. You say, these are the things you should consider. So the job of a monk, or a nun, or a teacher, or anyone in Buddhism, is to be a helper, an assistant, not a guide, if you like, but not to control anybody. Because that idea of control is totally alien to Buddhism. In the same way, we don't have controlling in our government system, we don't have controlling in our teaching system. So that girl comes up, and I just help her to make a clear decision. I clear the obstacles away. And I tell her, look, whichever choice you take, you will never ever be excommunicated from this place. You'll be always my friend and very, very welcome in this center. Because my job, having helped you to make a decision, and it's your decision, is to stand by you whichever way you go. And that's actually the Buddhist tradition there, of compassion, freedom, to make those choices. Because once the Buddha said, you are the owner of your karma, heir to your karma, born of your karma. Your karma is your decision, your choice. And the only job of a teacher is to try and help you make a clear choice. But it has to be each individual's choice, without control from outside. And just how that works, you know, in your life, it means because there's no control, there's no fear either. I don't know, many people come to the place like this because they get really pissed off at sort of some religions which actually say, if you don't come to church every Sunday, you'll go to hell. Or if you don't believe in so-and-so, no way can you go to heaven. And of course, you know the sort of the stupid things which people will believe in. Sometimes people control using fear. And because, you know, I was exposed to that as a Westerner for so many years, no way will I try and control other people with threats of expulsion or with threats that you won't be my friend anymore. Fear should never be an ingredient in decision making. And so when people make a controversial decision, say like an abortion, I say, look, please don't be afraid. Whichever choice you make, I'll be there for you. And sometimes that I'm just going on this, just this one example, it's just I've mentioned it, so I'm going to take it a little bit further. Because some people might tell you, if you commit an abortion, you're going to go to hell. It's bad karma. You're kidding something. And recently, as some of you know, there was a young man, 17-year-old, here in Perth, who committed suicide before his TE examinations. 17-year-old who killed himself. And one of his friends, when they came to see me at Bodhinyana Monastery for some counselling, he asked me that question, if you commit suicide, do you go to hell? As a Buddhist, really bad karma? And I gave him this example. And using examples really makes people see clearly. This is my job as a guide to people. I said, look, TE examination, how many papers does a person do? How many subjects? Is it six or seven? Six subjects. Say six subjects. In every one of those papers, six papers, how many questions do you have in each paper? Say 10, for example. So you have 10 questions in six papers, that's 60 questions you have to answer. If you stuff up one question, you really make a huge mess of one of those questions. Does it mean you don't get to university? Of course it doesn't. Got the other 59 questions you have to take into consideration. And I said, if you commit suicide, you've stuffed up one question, but you haven't stuffed up the whole examination of life, because there's many other choices and decisions you have made in life. So say just one event like a suicide does not send you to hell. It's what else you've done in life. In the same way, one abortion. That's just one decision out of 100,000 examination papers you call your life, tests. So when I put it in context, it makes no sense to say things like, no, don't do that or you go to hell. Life is much bigger and more complex than that, which is one of the reasons why we don't have any controlling by fear. And that's one of the great liberations of a person who comes to a place like this. Wow, I am not told what to do. I'm not forced what to do. I don't have any fear. You can go to one place when you're not afraid. Because if you do make a mistake, we actually learn from those mistakes. Remember what happens when you make a mistake? AFL code. I know that they're not playing anymore, but you know what AFL means. Acknowledge, forgive, learn. So we acknowledge what we're doing. Now we bring it up, yeah, this is what we've done, try and get as much information as possible, and then we forgive. Forgive means we don't have any punishments. When we don't have punishments, it takes away the fear in life. And then we learn. So no fear, but learning from what happens, growing from it, which is why we don't have any controlling. And because of that democratic system, now from the very beginning, the Buddha said, there would be no successor, no boss on top. He was also reflecting something even more profound. You know, how a Buddhist meditates without a controller. When you're meditating, please don't be the pope of your mind, telling yourself what to do. Watch the breath. If you don't watch the breath, you're going to get into big trouble. If you fall asleep again, if anyone snores in this, you'll be blackballed, we'll get a picture of you, put on the front over there, and we'll have guards to keep you out of this place forever afterwards, you snorer. We don't have that here. You know, here, you're free to make mistakes. You're free to do stupid things. And in fact, when you do a stupid thing, I love you when you do stupid things because you make me laugh. Just even 2 days ago in Singapore, I told you the stories when I do stupid things. And I told the story, I'm getting old now, so I don't remember when the last time I told the story of when I was in Penang. Just finishing off a retreat. And they took me to the airport, and it was just before midday, and I could still have, you know, some milk and ice cream. So they gave me this coffee, and it was milky coffee with ice cream in it, and it was absolutely delicious. I think I was told it's actually from Gloria Jean's. They had a shop in the airport in Penang, Gloria Jean's ice cream coffee, and I'd had it before, and it's absolutely delicious stuff. So they gave it to me, and because I didn't actually see it, they just gave it to me and said, "No, here, you know, you still got time to drink this." "Oh, thank you very much." Because I had a long flight, I needed a bit of a boost, and it was nice. So I started sort of sucking it through the straw, and sucking and sucking and sucking, and nothing was coming out. And that's when I looked at my sort of disciples, and, you know, because they respect you so much, they won't tell you what you're doing wrong. So I saw it, actually it wasn't the straw, it was a spoon. But it looked like a straw. And there I was, making my face red. And it's not for embarrassment, but just sucking for all I've got. Making a complete idiot of myself. But I told that on Wednesday night in Singapore, and I made 2,000 people happy. And I say it now, and I made 300, 400 people happy. So isn't it wonderful when you make a mistake? You don't have to be afraid or embarrassed. Share it. Share your mistakes with people. You bring so much lightness and happiness to the world. So that's why we don't have any fear, sort of, in this path. We don't have any control. Which means that even just in meditation, it's almost like a democratic meditation tradition. But you don't have this God inside your head telling you what to do. Buddhism is an atheistic religion. We don't believe in a controller God, which you have to pray to. Not like some great pope in the sky, some great monarch who you have to follow. And it's because, you know, the democratic system was begun with, it fat with sort of how the Buddha taught, even how the Buddha meditated. No God, no pope, no king, no person in charge, no monk controlling you. Do you get the picture here? This is a consistent freedom for every individual to make choices. If you're wrong choices, you learn from it, you laugh from it, you grow from it. No fear, because there's no one telling you off or punishing you for any type of mistakes. A free choice. Amazingly free choice. You're the owner of your karma. Sure, you'd have to take responsibility for what you do, but that's what we learn. That's how we learn. We give people the freedom and the choice and the ability to experiment. Now, that's also one of the things which, maybe this is just the way I've grown up, one of the reasons why I became a Buddhist. Because sometimes I just went to, in my trip to London, to UK recently, you know, I went to visit my old haunts in Cambridge. Now, where I found Buddhism, you know, was through books. But where I grew in Buddhism was the Cambridge University Buddhist Society. And what had happened, I'd read a book on Buddhism, and I was a Buddhist as soon as I finished reading that book. Basically, what I read, I realized that was me. For all those years, I'd been a Buddhist, but I didn't know, because I didn't know what Buddhism was. The first book, I knew I was a Buddhist. And I started telling people at 16 I was a Buddhist. But I never knew any other Buddhists in the whole of England. I thought, you know, I was the only one. None of my family could even spell the word, let alone know what it meant. But then when I went to Cambridge, they had something they called the Society's Fair. So all the different clubs and groups and societies, from fox hunting, they had a club there, you know, Cambridge, to all sorts of other astronomical society, the Psychic Research Society, I joined that. That's where you investigate ghosts. I was always interested in ghosts. So I joined the society for that. And I saw there, well, I remember going there and seeing there was a Buddhist society. And wow, I was just so excited. Well, I went up to the guy in the store, you know, and I said, I want to join. And he said, this is Buddhism, you don't have to join, just come and see. I said, no, I'm a Buddhist, I want to join. No, here's my pound. He said, no, you don't have to take, you know, to join up yet. Just try it out, first of all. And I was really aggressive. I want to join. You take my pound membership. And the fellow I argued is Professor Bernard Carve, University of London, a great old friend now. So, and he's a professor of physics. I was a physicist as well. And unfortunately, that he was in Toronto on my visit, but I called him up from Cambridge and we had a wonderful chat together. And that's where we first met. When I had to force him, because he was the treasurer that year, I had to force him to take my membership fee. So it was a beautiful sort of the freedom just which you had there of, you know, learning about the Dhamma and how you could grow. But one of the things which really impressed me with the university life at that college, at that time, was your encouragement. Encouragement not just to stay in your own field, not just to be told what to believe or what to know. The whole ethos in those years, in those great universities, was, here are all the resources. Some of the greatest professors, labs, libraries, use it. Don't just focus on your particular course. Go and listen to other lectures. This was like a treasure chest, and you were encouraged just to go and find out and follow your nose wherever you wish to go. And that's why in that university I went to philosophy lectures, architecture lectures, all sorts of lectures which have nothing to do with theoretical physics, but everything to do with your freedom to inquire and to grow. And maybe that was one of the reasons why I grew as a Buddhist and really embraced the sense of freedom of inquiry, freedom to choose, freedom to experiment. So, this is an experiment, ordaining bhikkhunis. It is a tough thing to do, because many people are very conservative and very afraid. And I apologize, you know, also on camera, if you hurt anybody. And my intention, you know me for many years, many very closely, you don't like hurting, you don't want to hurt people, that's not your intention. But your intention is to have an experiment, a freedom, to try it out and see what happens. It may not work. It may end up that they decide it's just too hard being a bhikkhunis. But we're giving it a try, and we have to give it a try. In life, you have to give it a try. I give it a try to become a bhikkhu, become a monk. I didn't have any fear. I know one of the reasons you didn't have any fear is becoming a bhikkhu, becoming a monk, because you could always disrobe at any time. Even that, the fear of making a decision which you'd have to keep forever is not part of Buddhism. So you can become a monk and you can disrobe at any time with respect. You're not considered, you're a failure, you disrobe. No. You know, you lasted 1 year or 2 years. Well done. You're a great person. You actually tried something and you did it for so long. Well done. It's that positive attitude which takes away the fear. So people can give it a try, being a monk, being a nun. Why not? You've nothing to lose. If it doesn't work out, you gain a lot. See what happens afterwards. And that freedom to experiment, to find out, experimenting even in your meditation. I tell a lot of people, look, when you get to a certain stage, where fear comes up, don't stop. Go through the fear in meditation. What's going to happen? Find out, for goodness sake. And that is really important for any of you who start really getting into your meditation. There comes a time in meditation when we all feel fear, because we're going to states of mind which you've never been to before. Without that encouragement, and my encouragement, I don't mind saying I'm a very accomplished meditator, so I've been further than any of you in here. So I know exactly what the path is, and I say, you have got nothing to fear. You've got huge amounts of bliss and freedom to experience, but sometimes fear comes up. And what is the fear in meditation? It's the fear of unknown. Where you're going to next. So my job as a teacher is to encourage you, yeah, go a little bit further and you'll have a wonderful time. My encouragement as whatever I can do as a leader, as Billy said, I'm not pushing this project of nuns ordination, but my hands are very dirty. I'm in it up to my neck, actually way above my neck. And you're doing this because you know there's nothing to fear. Go ahead, give it a try. Because you're only going to some very beautiful places. You know, and to each one of you, I mean, it's such an obvious thing. Why not? 21st century, it should happen 1918th century. One should have no discrimination at all. Discrimination has no moral basis at all. And it's, if anything is evil, it's discrimination just on your gender, on your age, on your sexual orientation, I gave a keynote talk at the disability conference in Ascot Racecourse this afternoon. I went to the races this morning, but there's no horses. And just the discrimination which we have with people who have schizophrenia, people who are somehow physically deformed. Even that discrimination is immoral. Why should we treat human beings different because an accident of their birth, which caused them, you know, to be one leg short of another, or their face, you know, to be not as beautiful as yours? I was going to say mine, but I decided to stop there. That type of discrimination has obviously got no place in our world. And where does discrimination come from? It all comes from ignorance and fear. So sometimes when we make these courageous steps, we're actually doing something wonderful for our world. We're lessening, diminishing people's fear. We're finding out it is okay to do these things. And it works that when you give people freedom, they don't abuse it. When you have control, all sorts of problems happen. I told this story to the group in Ascot Racecourse this morning about just how we try to even control disabled people and try and make them better, which is another form of controlling them. What is better anyway? So I told this story that, Max knows this story, I was told this, I haven't actually researched, I haven't got the documents, but came from a reliable source that maybe 20, 25 years ago in Jerusalem, the doctors went on strike for a week or two. So no doctors were working in many hospitals. And during those 2 weeks, the death rate plummeted. Well, that was amazing. When the doctors weren't involved, people started to get better. Now, that's a dangerous thing to say. So, you know, you go and see your doctor. You go in the hospital if you have an operation tomorrow, because otherwise the Buddhist Society would get sued. But what there was, the point behind that sometimes when we try and control and heal and change people, we sometimes make it worse. And you can see that in your life. When you try and control your children, especially when you control your partner, what do? You're controlling your partner. Why? Controlling your children. Why? Out of fear. Fear, if you let your children go to that nightclub, they're going to get into drugs, ice, heroin, the whole works. Your daughters are going to go and get pregnant. Your sons are going to go and get into a fight. That fear makes you control. You lose your children that way. They will realize you don't understand their needs. Sometimes it comes a time with your children where you have to trust them. You've given them all the means to protect themselves in life. You've guided them, helped them. Now, off you go. Be good, be careful, and that's all you can do. Because you love them enough to give them freedom. Or your partner. Sometimes you might doubt why your partner comes home very late on a Friday evening. Because you don't realize they're cleaning up in Dhammaloka Buddhist Center. So you hire a PI to follow them. And when your wife finds out, she says, "You don't trust me. I want a divorce." The thing you feared you make happen. And that's actually happened to quite a few people I know. When you don't have trust, you don't give them freedom, the thing which you fear often comes about. So please, in your marriage, in your relationship, don't be a pope. Don't be a controller. Because if you control because of fear, it's all going to go wrong. And that's one of the reasons why the Buddha set up this monastic system with no controls from outside. To have it an organic evolutionary whole. We are going to be judged. My monastery in Bodhi Nyana is going to be judged by its success, not from outside. Whether it, say, cuts the mustard, whether it reaches people, whether it connects with people, whether it makes people inspired, and whether it makes the monks inspired to get more and more monks. Dharmasara Nun's monastery is going to succeed or fail, not because of what the Buddhist society outside does, or what I do, or what any other monk or nun in any other part of the world does. It's because of what these four heroes or heroines do in their monastic life. And all the ones who come afterwards, if they teach right, the right way, then it succeeds. So we don't need the control from outside. All we have is the control from our rules of discipline, the simplicity, the renunciation, the kindness, the generosity. That's what runs us. So when the Buddha said, no, there won't be a controller, there won't be a successor who tells you what to do, he said, let the Dhamma, the truth, and sort of the guidelines, our precepts, let that be your guide from here on in. So that's how we work. That's our ethos. It gives us a huge amount of freedom, but also a lot of personal responsibility. We have to make the choices. Without selfishness, without anger, without stupidity, without fear. We make the choices. We grow and learn from the consequences. And this is actually how we grow, and how you will grow in your life. Make those choices. Don't be timid. Make those choices and see what happens. That's how it's encouraged in Cambridge. You know that there was I wasn't a very sporting man as a young man. I like to watch sport. But you know I don't know if you know this, the monks know this. There was only one sport where I represented Cambridge against Oxford. You know that Cambridge and Oxford, they always have these competitions together. Only one sport where I represented Cambridge. What do you think that was? No, not rowing, not debating, not chess, no. It was tiddlywinks. Because I never took sport seriously. If you're going to play sport, it had to be for fun. So the only sport where I represented Cambridge was at tiddlywinks. Because that way there was no controller. And when we went up to there's a group of my friends, the people I partied with and hung about, and we all met, not all of us, but quite a few of us met together just when I was in England just last week. The remnants of the Emmanuel College Cambridge Tiddlywinks Society. The alumni. One of them was the head of British Coal. Another one was, I think, almost the top actuary in the whole of Europe. Another one, he was the China expert in the British Foreign Office. And another one is Abbot of Bodhi Nyana Monastery. This is the alumni of the Emmanuel College Tiddlywinks Club. And when we went up, to get some funding for this thing, we thought, this is a stupid thing to ask all these professors. And when we went out to ask a professor for some funding for our Tiddlywinks Society, they said, what a wonderful idea. What a great thing to do. Here's the money. That actually shook me, because I remember that occasion. What they were saying, go ahead, give it a try. You were given that encouragement, not control, not to hold you back. But here's brilliant young men. Go for it, wherever you want to go. Explore life. And don't be afraid. Take those chances, make those choices, and don't be timid people. Maybe because of that lack of timidity, which I got from a place like Cambridge, made me take the chance of becoming a monk. See what happens. made me sort of take those opportunities which come up in meditation. Yeah, let's go for it. Let's go for that bliss. Let's go beyond that fear. Let's go for those beautiful nimittas in meditation. Take away these barriers of fear and control, which literally free you, not just to form a Tiddlywinks club, but to get into the deepest of meditations and to form Buddhist societies, monasteries, nuns' monasteries, retreat centres, establishing bhikkhuni ordinations. That's my conditioning, or rather deconditioning, to take away your fear and to give you that courage and the ability to learn from whatever you decide to do and to make it work. Whether you go left or right when you leave this hall, you can always go back to the car park. If you go around the central park over there, clockwise or anti-clockwise, you can still get back to your car. It's just a different path. Never a wrong path, never a right path, just a different path. And unless we have that encouragement and that freedom to explore, our life will be less for following fear. So the decisions which we made here last night or over many, many years, so actually to come to this occasion of having bhikkhunis, full bhikkhunis in Australia, ordained here as part of the Thai lineage, that's going to have huge ramifications. But the best part of it is why we did it. Because it needed to be done and we had no fear. And that's what the lesson of this occasion is tonight. When you make your decisions, other people may be on your back saying, don't do it, you shouldn't do it. What do you feel? Don't be controlled by others. Follow your heart. Buddha said, there's no successor except the Dhamma and Vinaya, the precepts, the truth, which is in your heart. In UK, 2 years ago, I gave a session to the Ministry of Defence personnel, frontline soldiers in a Buddhist army who are Buddhists, people who were in Afghanistan with rifles and bullets. They were so impressed by what I said, they came back to have another session with me and record it for the other people in the military who want to follow a Buddhist path. Is it right, as a soldier, to have a gun and be a Buddhist? I will not tell you. You have to make that decision. But I told them one important little saying, which as soon as I said it, because of the context, one of the soldiers, a woman, just burst out, wow. I told her, never let knowledge stand in the way of truth. Never let all you know about Buddhism stand in the way of truth. Because all that knowledge, all those words, all those precepts, all that Dhamma which you've learned, read and even memorized, that is only just pointed to something. The truth in your own heart. That's how we make decisions. We're fearless enough to see the truth in our own heart. And you know if something is right and something is wrong. You know it in your heart. And for the last week, or looking at my heart, I knew very clearly the ordination of bhikkhunis was right. So we've done it. And what a wonderful day it is for Buddhism here in Western Australia and the world. Thank you for listening. Thank you. Okay, now you have some. You going to show people your certificates? They brought them here today, so you might as well show them up. This is the authentic certificate to show them they are legally fully ordained bhikkhunis. What a wonderful thing that is to actually just to have something like that. So you can come and see them afterwards. But anyway, usually any questions or comments about what's been said? No. Any questions or comments? Yes. Why do nuns have darker robes and the monks have lighter robes? basically so we can see who's who. That's true. Because otherwise we had all the same colour. You wouldn't know who's a monk and who's a nun. So, you know, you may sort of, you know, see someone dressed like me going into the women's toilets and say, I saw Ajahn Brahm going to the women's toilets. So you know, now this is monk, dark is nun. So that's what it is, really is. So it isn't that they're on the dark side and we're on the light side. We're all on the Buddha's side. So that's why they're more dark. Just so you know who's who. But this is actually, sometimes clothes tell you that, or hairstyles. You know, we have all these ways of knowing whether you're a boy or a girl because of convenience. So when you shave your hair and you wear these floppy robes, there's actually nothing, you can't see your figure underneath. You know, because you know, the nuns don't wear these, I think they're called wonder bras, aren't they? Which make your figures go up. Accentuate things. You know, they don't have girlish hairstyles. So, you know, you can't tell. Now, there's a wonderful teaching there that what is this man or woman difference? If you take away all the signs, you know, the different type of hairstyle or you know, the figure, we are all the same. Isn't that a wonderful thing to know? All these differences between men and women which create so much problems in the world, huge amount of problems, it's just what we add on to the human being. When you start life as a baby, you look the same. When you get to a certain age, you look the same. Just in between, it's just a little while, there's a separation, you know, because of our accentuated, you know, gender differences. Just for procreation. And after that's finished, then we can all come together again. So that's the only reason why we're different. Yes? Okay, what was her situation before? She had the 10 precepts, so it was like a seminary, like a novice monk, a 10 preceptor. And when we first did this, we didn't really know whether bhikkhuni ordination was even possible. So we had the 10 precepts and we tried to give as much equality as possible. So usually, now the reason you didn't know this is because deliberately I said monk, nun, and without any technicalities, there was a sense of equality in your eyes. But as people got to know the situation more, they realized, you know, that it wasn't totally equal. Because you begin to learn more Buddhism. You can go into the books, nothing is hidden. You can actually read it for yourself. There were bhikkhunis, and they weren't bhikkhunis. It's great that as Buddhism spreads in our Western world, the Westerners are learning and they're finding out. So monks, we can't hide anything. They do find out, yeah, there were bhikkhunis in the time of the Buddha, and before they weren't bhikkhunis. Why? And I've been asked that question so many times over the last 9 years. And the answer can only be, why not? So let's do it. So many talks, but we need some action, so we've done some action now. So that was the status before, 10 preceptors, not the full bhikkhunis. Now actually they have more precepts than I have. Is that fair? I want more precepts. I want more. Any other question or comments? Okay, we can. Yeah, go.
So, was this controversial?
I think the only reason why it was controversial, not because of the precepts, I think it was just because of change. Because sometimes, especially the Asian tradition, and you know that the Asian tradition has so much respect for parents and for teachers and for masters, people feel that you should always follow what your teacher says. You should always follow what your parents say. And that if you go against your parents' advice, that's lacking filial piety. And it's because of that that even in schools, say in China when I was young, it would be rote learning. The teacher said, this is what the law is, this is what the maths is, this is what the history is, and you'd have to believe it. You weren't allowed to question your teacher. even in Europe until recently, you weren't allowed to question. Your teacher, your parents, your betters, you'd always have to accede to them. There has been a huge revolution in the last 100 years throughout the whole world, where people have had that freedom to think. And that's been fought for with the blood of many, many brave people. The freedom to think, the freedom to vote, the freedom to have your ideas valued and counted. That has started to come in to countries like Thailand, but you all know Thai politics. It's not really full democracy, I have to say. On the outside it looks like democracy. In China, the system over there, is it really democracy? So that is very ancient tradition. In Buddhism, from the very beginning, we were rebelling against that. From the time of the Buddha, rebelled against that. And actually maintained its growth throughout the whole of democracies and monarchies and dictatorships. Managed to maintain itself throughout all those centuries because of its strength and power in its democratic, free ethos. But still, that ancient, it used to be in Europe as well, always following your teachers and never questioning them. And along comes Western monks in the Thai tradition. And we've come from educations which not only encourage us to question, but enable us to question, give us the intellectual strength to question. And that is changing Asia, which is only for the best. Yes? Yeah, we all shave our hair because we can't afford to go to hairdressers. I was in Sydney, it's $90 to go to a hairdresser. Why they should have to shave their head is because it's an act of giving up your sense of self, your sense of ego. It's freely chosen to join that order. It's just our rules, it's just... As the Buddha said, it's not coming from anyone else except from the Buddha himself 2600 years ago. And we expect that of monks. It's almost our uniform. If she didn't shave her hair and she grew long hair, I'd probably grow long hair as well. You know, when I was a young man, my friends were telling me I've changed a lot because I used to have, my curly hair would go all the way down to here, big, all the way out here. And where it stopped, that's where my beard started. On all the way around here. It was very practical in England because it gets so cold over there. You never had to wear a beanie. You've got this beautiful fuzz all around your hair. it's part of our uniform actually to shave our hair. And it's one way of renouncing ego. Showing that we're letting go of one of the things which distinguishes us, our hairstyle. Yes? Well, a bhikkhu is literally someone who depends upon alms food. Because bhikkhu is almost like the alms, the dropping of things into a bowl. And bhikkhuni is the female form for that. So it's in the old ancient Pali, which is a dialect of Sanskrit, like a cow and a bull. Different words for the different genders of the same species. So you've got bhikkhu and bhikkhuni. So that's the only reason. It's the absolute equivalent of the bhikkhu, bhikkhuni. Yeah? The 10 precepts, the nun, like the novice, was not fully admitted to the whole Sangha. It wasn't like a full ordination, it was like a half ordination. And it was usually just for people who were about to become full ordained monks and nuns. Mostly actually for people under age, because there was an age limit, you had to be at least 20 years of age to get full ordination. So if a person was staying in a monastery at 17, 18 or 16 or whatever, then they'd be 10 preceptors. And they'd take the full precepts after their 20th birthday, or after 20 years. Okay, yes.
Yeah.
If Ajahn Chah was alive today, I know exactly what he would say, because this is so common what he would say when we'd ask him a question. He'd say, you know, I wanted to do this, and he would say, have you any doubts? And if he said, no, I haven't any doubts, he'd go ahead and do it. That was so common. And that actually shows the measure of that teacher. He would not control you, say, are you really sure what you're doing? He would actually make sure you made a wise decision, well considered, and you weren't being foolish or hasty. That's how what he would say so often. If I'd have asked him, if he was alive, I know what he would say. Ajahn Brahm, you got any doubts? And I would actually stop. I wouldn't just say no straight away. I'd really investigate. Have I any doubts left? And if I said no, he said, go ahead. Now that is a good Buddhist monk. Not trying to control you as, you know, his disciple, but to give you that freedom, but to check you, to make sure you're making a decision with full consideration. That's our tradition, the real tradition. Yes. Mahayana Buddhism, we know that mostly the Chinese tradition in Hong Kong, mainland China, Taiwan. That's the heart of it, basically. Now, one of the reasons why this ordination is valid, you do need other bhikkhunis to actually to generate more bhikkhunis. And one of the pieces of research which actually changed my mind is that it's open, it can be done, because we can use the Chinese lineage. That as far as the monks or nuns are concerned, you are a monk first, a disciple of the Buddha, you are a bhikkhu or you are a bhikkhuni. Having become a bhikkhu, then you can become Mahayana or Theravada. You're not a Theravada bhikkhu, you're a bhikkhu who chooses Theravada. You're not a Mahayana bhikkhuni, you are a bhikkhuni who chooses the Mahayana path or the Theravada path. We are all of that same lineage. So those bhikkhunis in China, their lineage is exactly the coming from the Buddha. There is no separation into different traditions. The vinaya, these are the precepts, is exactly the same for all Mahayana, Theravada, Vajrayana, all of Buddhism. The precepts, especially the ordination ceremony, is the same. When I investigated and found, how do the nuns, the Mahayana nuns in China, how are they ordained? Exactly the same way as those present at Bodhinyana Monastery last night saw. Exactly the same. Dual Sangha, first in the Bhikkhuni Sangha, then in the Monk Sangha, the chanting is the same. Only in China it was done in Chinese. Here we do it in Pali. But exactly the same meaning, the same words. When I saw that, I realized those bhikkhunis over in China, they are bhikkhunis. They wear different type of robes, they may believe in different sutras, but they are valid bhikkhunis. And any bhikkhus, as you, many of you who visited Bodhinyana know, this year we've been privileged to have two bhikkhus from Korea. They are bhikkhus who follow Mahayana. They're not Mahayana bhikkhus. So they've been living with us for how many months now? 4 months? And they'll be here next weekend, because I want to sort of check this place out. They just get on so well that they're our friends. They can stay as long as they like. The only difference is they got slightly different coloured robes, but they laugh at the same jokes. They do the same meditation. So the difference is there is only what you choose to follow in your Dhamma, not in your vinaya, in your precepts. The precepts are the same. Because the precepts are the same, that's why we could use that lineage to authenticate the ordination in Theravada. That's why we use those Mahayana. Thank you, China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, for preserving that tradition. So now we can bring that seed from that country to reinstate it in Theravada. So this ordination is thanks for the many, many centuries of women taking ordination as bhikkhunis in China. Yeah. Yeah, last night they were all Theravadan bhikkhunis. Okay, just two more questions and we have to finish off because... But yes? Yeah, you always address, a proper way to address us is your emptiness. Venerable. Venerable is fine. What about Aya? No, just venerable. So, but Venerable Ajahn Wayama. Ajahn is fine, yeah. Ajahn Wayama, then Ajahn. So basically, the same as always. And last question was over here somewhere, yes. Why did they? Why did it cease? That's a great question. I think a lot of time in those sorts of cultures, and this is something the Buddha said, and this is something I want to point out to each one of you. The Buddha said that women come by things with greater difficulty than the men. And most of the support will go to the monks' monasteries, not the nuns' monasteries. So all of you, when you give your donations, where you give your donations? Is it just to Bodhinyana Monastery or to Dharamsala Monastery? When you go and bring dana, where do you usually go? More people go to Bodhinyana Monastery than they go to Dharamsala. I think that needs to be changed. And that's one of the reasons why it disappeared. The support wasn't there as strong as it was for the monks. But maybe that was a cultural condition in Asia. But it's not the condition here now. So now you have bhikkhunis. Support them. It's a great step we've got to get this far. And certainly, you know, all the Sangha which has come from overseas, the monk Sangha here, we've done our bit and these have done their bit. Now it's up to you to support the Bhikkhuni Sangha here in Western Australia so it does not die out. So it can be a seed for taking this Bhikkhuni Sangha all over the world. We should be proud. Australia got it first. Okay, thank you again for listening.
Satipano bhagavato sāvaka-saṅgho